Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And who are we speaking to today, Daisy?
Today we're speaking with W. David Marks. He's an American writer who lives and works in Tokyo, Japan. And he's been writing his newsletter, Culture and Owner's Manual, since 2022. His most recent book, Status and Culture, How Our Desire for Social Rank Creates Taste, Identity, Art, Fashion, and Constant Change, was published in 2022. And his next book, Blank Space, A Cultural History of the 21st Century, will be published this November.
This was a good episode. I think pulling back the curtain for the reader for a second, it was an interesting one in that we recorded it evening our time and right after David was waking up, which I was grateful for because I'm a little tired by the end of the day. But he really brought the energy on this one.
Tasteland After Dark.
Tasteland After Dark. I really enjoyed this one. I really like listening to David talk. He's very smart.
I'm excited to find out if there's a time of day when my vocal fry is worse.
When it's worse.
Yeah.
Do you want to get some bad reviews, some one-star reviews on Apple Podcasts?
No, I'm always just trying to optimize myself.
Wouldn't that be in shitification?
I don't know. In fryification? this is the problem. It's a paradox because it's worse when I'm relaxed. Mm. So actually, the more I'm in an environment where I feel comfortable,
maybe
the
you
worse
should record in
it
the subway.
Is. Maybe I should record in the subway.
Subway tastes.
Subway tastes. Yeah, exactly. We should have, maybe we can have Cream on the podcast.
Yeah, I would happily.
It could just be a super cut of every take.
A super cut of every take.
He's ever said 100% too. Oh,
so we wouldn't actually have him on. We would just take his clips, clip every time he says that, and then put that together.
That's the definition of clip farming.
All right. Yeah. Okay, clip farmers, get your tractors ready. Let's go talk to David Marks. Okay, as a way into this, I want to talk about something Daisy just wrote that we haven't talked about on the pod yet. Daisy, your piece in the New York Times about how there could be still no Song of the Summer this summer. Mm.
I would argue there's still no Song of the Summer. Although Pitchfork, I mean, I don't want to claim that they were influenced by me, but they did, shortly after it came out, they did do their arguments for what they think the Song of the Summer is.
Well, they have to do that every year, Pitchfork, don't they?
They do, but I feel like the framing was different this time. The framing was like that most people would think that there's no clear winner. Yeah. It was less consensus than I think it has been in the past, but I don't know. David, did you see that discourse?
No, although I was watching Andor, and there's the scene where, like, she's in the wedding death dance marathon rave thing. And I was like, you know, it'd be a funny idea is if people considered that to be the Song of the Summer. And then Vanity Fair wrote a piece like, that's the Song of the Summer or something like that. Mm.
Interesting.
So that was one. I mean, last year, I followed it last year because I think it was very clear that there wasn't one. And again, all the examples given were kind of pathetic, which was one of them was the East European techno parody, the State of Base. Was that what it was called?
Yeah.
But wasn't last about a summer pony. Like Espresso?
That was definitely Espresso. Or it was also Brat Summer.
But that's like the album. But I feel like the song was Espresso, weirdly.
Yeah, that's true. But like Brat Summer, the more distance I get from it, I feel like was an actual thing. It wasn't just a marketing scheme. Like the people really felt it. And it did feel like that last moment before the end of the world that like there's a chance that we may save ourselves from this, but we didn't. But like in that moment, in that summer, it felt kind of exciting. Like
it was part of that falling short. Yeah. It was Kamala's.
Exactly.
It was
Kamala's thing. Yeah, we were driving to Massachusetts for a wedding and we stopped at this rest stop and I like pointed to a parking spot and I was like, that's where I was when I found out Joe Biden dropped out of the race. And Ben just like looks out the window wistfully and goes, that was such a good week. Yeah. And it was like, it really was only a week. a week of hope. But it's so funny.
I think it's not funny. My personal, these are not the songs of the summer, but thing I'll say about it and then we can move on. My personal two songs of the summer that I've probably been listening to the most are, I think it's called The Field by Blood Orange, and there's like six mm-hmm. people on it. Caroline Polachek, what's his name from the Daruti column, Vinnie Riley, and then the Ethel Kane song Fuck Me Eyes, in a very similar way to American Teenager. Mm-hmm. I've been listening to it a lot, like if I'm biking somewhere, it's a perfect like summer going fast song. But these are not songs that you would hear coming out of a car.
Right. It's a great song, but like it's never gonna be like co-opted by marketing. Even like American mm-hmm. Teenager wasn't. It was on the Obama list, but I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. In any marketing campaigns.
A regular Born in the USA moment.
Justin Bieber came in pretty hot with Daisies.
Okay, well, there's some obvious bias here at play.
I'm just saying. These are just the facts. It also was in that Pitchfork roundup. We do actually have a piece coming out about whether there's a summer blockbuster. Mm. I don't know. It's hard. Like,
I just saw Weapons.
How was it?
It was good. I like Barbarian. I'm not a scary movie guy. I get too scared.
Yeah, me too, Francis. It's okay.
Thank you. But I wanted to say, because Barbarian was really good. I thought it was like a fun movie that happens to have some scares in it. And I thought that was the mm-hmm. same here. I think that Weapons, the funny parts of Weapons are funnier than the scary parts are scary. And there's only like maybe a handful of parts where I was truly like freaked out. But I don't know. Is it a summer blockbuster? I'm reminded too. I just finished, as we record this, I just finished the Keith McNally memoir last night, and he had a line in there about he loves movies, talks about movies a lot. And he wistfully notes how Star Wars, which he's seen, but it wasn't until Star Wars came out that press started talking about how much movies made at the box office, which felt, you know, which is very funny, because I feel like in the past 2 years, it's people saying stuff, like tweeting stuff like, oh, it wasn't until people started being obsessed with A24 that everybody started talking about how much money a film made.
Yeah, that's definitely not true. David, I want to get you in here, and I know you're just like waking up.
No, I'm fine. I was just thinking my song of the summer was Carnival by Natalie Merchant, because I completely forgot that song existed for about 20 or 30 years or whatever it was. And so just to rediscover that, like, oh, I knew this song and it was great, and then to listen to it again was really fun. But that doesn't count, obviously.
I like to say that every summer, my song of the summer has been Atlantic City by the band, not the original Bruce Springsteen song. So I think it's okay to have a vintage song of the summer.
I think that's a really good one, David. And I've been experiencing a lot of like global coffee house aesthetic nostalgia. And Natalie Merchant, I feel like, is a bit of a poster child.
I don't know the song. I probably know it by ear. I don't know it by name.
You're probably a little young. I mean, I grew up on 10,000 Maniacs. Because my brother and sister are much older. Mm-hmm. And so I was like into that when I was 9 or something, like very precocious. And then as a high school kid we had alternative radio for exactly 18 months in Pensacola. Mm-hmm. And that was like a staple of that radio station. It was like just that song hit the exact time we had a radio station. So mm-hmm. I knew that one. And then I guess, did she do Lilith Fair? That was a big thing. I don't know. Being a performative male in 1990s, you had to know a lot of Tori Amos and
man, if they brought Lilith Fair back today, well, I think it would make Gamergate look like a state fair.
My peak performative male moment in high school, probably by senior year of high school. This is I graduated high school 2012. Was, you know, I discovered Urban Outfitters. I grew up in rural Northern California, so you know, I bought some. I had like this Fair Isle patterned hoodie that I got from Urban Outfitters in senior year.
Urban Everybody Outfitters must hit so hard those. If you grew up on a farm.
Oh my god, mm-hmm. Wearing those some Clarks, some kind of like oxblood Clarks.
Yep. Francis is to Urban Outfitters as a city dweller, city kid is to Carhartt.
True. My Carhartt, my dad gave me. On the farm, so you know, I still have it. It's getting a little small on me now, you know, some 15, 16 years on, but yeah, it's authentic.
I wouldn't wear Carhartt. I mean, now that they have like the WIP stuff, and I did an article with them, I got some and I wear it. But
I saw that
for a long time, I would never wear it because it felt like stolen valor. Like I should be on a like a road crew, or otherwise I shouldn't wear it.
Do people wear it in Tokyo? You ever spot it?
Everyone wears it.
Yeah.
As an aside, I've been I went to Blue and Green recently. I've been considering buying a pair of Orslo jeans. Mm-hmm. But I was talking to the guy at the shop there. They had they're these really big ones. That's like the super dad fit. But we were talking about precisely this. How I was like, oh, I tried them on. I was like, oh, these are nice. Like I like how they look. But I feel like it's too late in the trend cycle of the big pant for me to buy into the big pant.
I disagree.
I was gonna say so. I really like them. It's like I could wear them, but I feel like walking around, I just might feel a bit too much like a performative male. Whereas I tried the shoe cut I tried on, which is sort of a bell bottom. That I felt like was just right, just weird enough. But I wasn't ready to shell out.
I think silhouette trend cycle moves kind of at a 20th century pace. Like it's much slower and. You have that moment where you have to be the first one to wear the big pants, and then everyone's like, "Ooh, big pants!" And then, like 6 months later, you don't even think they're big anymore; they don't look big. That happened to me in Tokyo. There was the big silhouette thing really did start here.
Yeah,
and I mean, how big can you go though before the cycle restarts?
Yeah, but it just can't go back to skinny again because there's too many people who vote Republican that wear really skinny jeans.
Yeah. I truly believe it can't go fully back to skinny.
It can't go fully back. So I mean, it can stabilize a little bit and like not look as intensely wide, but it's not going to go back to like skin tight.
Are we talking women's jeans or men's jeans or both?
This is all men's. I have no authority to speak on behalf of women's fashion.
Women still wear skin tight jeans. They never stopped.
Yeah. But men, it's like this weird thing where wearing the skinniest jeans means that you're Pete Hegsig or something.
Yeah. Right? And you work out in them with RFK.
Yeah.
Right. Well, David, I wonder if like we could force my Times piece in conversation with your piece about what's going on with Labubu, where you know,
only fads, a great turn of phrase.
Only fads, right. Like, is the sort of lack of a consensus blockbuster or consensus song of the summer part of the OnlyFads phenomenon? Mm. Also, you should probably explain OnlyFads for our listeners.
There was an article by Amanda Mull, who's now at Bloomberg, who was at The Atlantic for a long time, who's a great consumer culture reporter. And she was just looking at Labubu's and Dubai Chocolate and saying, like, where did these come from? And I think for a lot of educated upper middle class, especially American consumers, these things just feel random. Like they didn't come out of some community somewhere that's been doing it for a long time. They do feel like they're very fast moving and fads, and they're coming from places not traditionally in the cultural production network, in the sense of Dubai until now has not been a center for cultural production. And you know, whether Dubai Chocolate's actually from Dubai or not, it's probably a whole debate. And Labubu's they're a Hong Kong illustrator, but it's being sold through Pop Mart, which is a mainland China retailer. So some of it going on, it's kind of things are coming out of nowhere, as in not the West. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that these just feel bizarre in the sense of like, why this thing now? So these are fads. And I mean, I guess my number one point was like, we've always had fads, like in the 50s. Like if you ever read a history of the 50s, it's like the whole culture was fads, except for you also had Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe and, you know, all this other stuff that stuck. And so it feels like the difference now is that it's only fads, that the culture, and to be a cultural person with media literacy means to be on the pulse of like, this week we're talking about this and next week we're going to be talking about this, and like this kind of endless cycle of
empty fads. You're on like the fad beat. Mm-hmm. Like nobody has a film critic anymore and they have like five fad reporters.
Right. And so that's kind of where culture is. So you have this monoculture of chasing micro trend fads, and nothing really sticks, obviously, with that. And I had read Simon Reynolds' Retromania when it came out, like 2010 or 11. I thought, like, this is the book that best defines the 21st century at the time, because it was like, okay, yes, we're getting into retro and things aren't really moving. And I was trying to figure out why that was happening. And I think what I got to was status and culture, was fashions used to be the kind of thing, and some of it was we lacked the meta knowledge to know how fashions worked, but it's like wide ties are in everybody, and everyone said, well, of course I have to buy a wide tie. They didn't have any kind of knowledge that, like, you know, in 2 or 3 years you're going to be wearing skinny ties again. And so we weren't even having this trend mechanism discussion.
Can you go back? Like, what does it mean to lack the meta knowledge? People, is it just like people didn't have insight into the supply chain of the sort of like turquoise sweater trickle down of their lives? Or
I think that's half of it. And then the second is there was a sense that everyone was doing it, therefore you had to do it. So there was less need to, I need to break from the cycle. There was less knowledge that the cycle worked the way it did. I mean, as much as I think The Tipping Point is the least bad Gladwell book, but like that book at least put on people's like radars that there was this thing called the trend cycle for a lot of people that was still kind of obscure sociological knowledge. So, you know, people didn't really know this stuff in the 60s. So if you go back and watch a film from the 60s, like 65, 66, 67, the fashion in every single one of those movies is completely different because everyone is like legitimately adopting whatever style at the time as part of their identity. So like they're going all in, and the whole society is going all in every year. And so you really get these big social changes. So I think now it's like we live in a world where not only are we consuming these fads, but we know they're fads. So we could be like, Labubu, let's talk about Labubu, but I'm not actually going to buy one. I'm not going to put it on my bag. And I'm certainly not going to put it on my bag for more than 2 months or 3 months or something. And so then it just doesn't become kind of a society-wide aesthetic. And the way we understand it at the time and the way we look back on it is like, well, that was superficial and stupid. It was just like for fun. It wasn't meaningful. Like there was actually a confusion that fashion was meaningful in the 20th century.
So is the contemporary category of a fad to, like, the condition of a fad is to know that it's a fad while you're participating? Yeah.
I think that's right. So it's like you have the meta knowledge that I'm going to lightly play with this thing, but it's not me.
Right.
Don't judge me on this.
And I think like you sort of get into this, but like Asian consumerism has sort of been optimized towards fads for a while. Like, and I think that they're actually able to do that and coexist with like more of a meta intellectualism than like Americans are. Like, I feel like even Americans that know their fads like are still getting one-shotted by Stanley water bottles. And it's like, you gotta stop. Like, what is it about? I don't know. Like, I feel like because this stuff is originating and not the West, like K-pop stans are almost like inoculated from the type of things that Americans get incredibly like distracted by. And I just wonder, I mean, I wonder why that is, but this is a theory that I'm sort of thinking aloud on.
But I think that they're not self-conscious. They're just like, yeah, Labubu is just fun. It's great.
Mm-hmm.
That like, there's nothing, there's no hand-wringing. It was the word I used in the piece about it. And the way that Amanda's piece is kind of like, what are we going to do about this? It's like, that's the thing in the background. And that's how I'm thinking about it too. Whereas I think people in Asia are just like, yeah, it's Labubu today. It could be something else tomorrow. It's not a big deal. So you get more what I call earnest consumption. And I think the other thing about short video is a lot of people of our generation are aware that short video is where the world is, and we partake in it and we get sucked into it. But, we don't like it, or we're like ironically, half ironically consuming it, where there's just a lot of places where that is media is short form video. And so if you're watching these videos and people have Labubu, and then you're like, I'm gonna get a Labubu and I'm gonna show it off in my short video, it's just an earnest consumption cycle. And so it makes more sense that cultural production will move to where earnest consumption is happening, not this kind of hand-wringing half ironic consumption. So that's kind of my sense of things. And the other thing about Labubu that's, I think, actually the real sign of what's going on at the moment is there is a nexus of K-pop, Greater China Capital, Hong Kong in particular being kind of the creative powerhouse for mainland China. Mainland China doesn't have quite the creative production yet, but they've got access to Hong Kong, which has developed a lot of it. The French brands... the French like conglomerates are really leaning high, like deep into Asia and deep into K-pop. When you go to like a Louis Vuitton menswear show, and you hear people screaming, it's because there's like 500 people, like K-pop fans lined up outside to see the K-pop stars.
Well, there's Jay-Z the Arno Scion, like, and then Lisa is like dating Lisa or whatever, who then I only learned this from your newsletter. Part of how it blew up, how Lububu blew up, was she put it on her Louis bag, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like the French conglomerate plus K-pop, and then K-pop kind of like legitimizes it for all of Asia, and then mainland China money. Anyway, that's like, to me, that's the new nexus of cultural production, is that group. And that really is a rival to the US as kind of the only place that pop culture can happen. Or
yeah, I guess another parallel I see is like, because of Shein, Americans were able to participate in specifically fashion micro trends with a very low barrier to entry because the clothes are so cheap. But does getting like participating in micro trends and getting like the cheap clothes and then making the video about it, like to close the loop, does that mean Americans are more or less earnest about fads? Or are we like, we're less earnest, but we do more hand wringing, so we have more of a fad?
There's both going on at the same time in the US, which is there's like the pundit class that's doing the hand wringing but not judging, and like I'm half in, half out. And then there's people just earnestly doing it. Like for every haul video, like every 10 haul videos, there was like an article about haul videos.
Well, I think, something you had another newsletter in March titled The Age of the Double Sellout. And I wrote down a quote here that I'm looking at now. And I think it's like the flip side of this, right? Like we're talking about like consuming trends, right? So what I wrote down is, in the last 3 decades, youth culture has moved from a deep suspicion of commerce to a passionate defense of anti-commerce, to an entire generation of creatives who leverage the commercial market to do even more commerce. And then another one from later in the post, the 21st century has been the age of the double sellout, creators who produce market-friendly content to achieve fame and then use that fame to pursue even more commerce for commerce's sake. So that's kind of the creator side of it and how we view creators as consumers. But what we're talking about right now is sort of the consumer side of it, where it's like consumption for consumption's sake maybe is accelerated. And like you're saying, like the pundit class maybe will be hand-wringing and over-intellectualizing, but your average person who's just scrolling TikTok and sees Labubu or whatever and hits buy on TikTok shop, like that's just like a normal mode because this fast-paced consumption from your phone, I want it, I buy it, I have it, it was cheap, I'll do the same again next week. That's just normalized.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that in the US there are people who are earnest consumers, but there's just this other layer of narrative that's the, what are we going to do about it? Or what does this mean kind of side? And Asia probably has less of that. I don't want to say that there's none of the media narrative about it, but I think the media analysis as part of the narrative, but in the US, the way we all consume it. And that's my other point of the Lububu piece is, I'm not going to ever buy one. It's just, I can say that right now, but I feel, to be a media literate person, I had to know what they are. Yeah. And I was hearing about them and people were talking about them. And it, like I had to have a moment and stop, be like, okay, I got to figure this out.
Would you like me to turn you into a Labubu, David? I have a filter app for that.
You have an app for that?
Amazing. Sure,
yeah.
Wait, okay. And you go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. And then the to match it with the sellouts piece, I mean, the other part of this is I don't think there's the bias against seeing things that are popular. Oh, that's just a cash grab. Oh, I'm being manipulated because this is just commerce. The way that I think we were hypersensitive to that 30 years ago. So the consumer themselves can't even see through like, oh, this is just I'm being manipulated by a big company to buy a thing.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I just saw Eddington a week or two ago, and we don't need to talk about the whole movie, but one thing I thought it did really well was how it depicts people on their phones and how we interact with our phone, what our phones do to us. That style of like, well, it's online, and so now it's our duty to kind of interact with it in a similar way is what's going on with Labubu, where it's like, oh, I saw it on the internet and now like I have to consume it because that's the thing right now. In the same way where you'll see like, you know, that kind of like right-wing Twitter thing, like that meme that's like, oh, the current thing. Liberals are all up in arms about the current thing, right? Like this is kind of a not cynical, just earnest way.
I mean, I am on like partially on right wing Twitter against my consent, and I guess all of us are.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say.
But I would say like people who don't consider themselves right wing, who consider themselves heterodox, but I consider right wing. Nobody loves doing current thing discourse more than tech people that live in San Francisco. I think they're currently debating Rothko right now.
I saw that.
And the thing about it, that's
this is worth more than $20.
I mean, also like to close the loop on like what you're saying is like obviously protest movements and Labubu are very different, but everything is disseminated through the same apparatus now. And so if you want to dismiss something, you call it a fad, right? Because you're able to fall back on the temporary nature of our media cycle to dismiss whatever you want to dismiss. You know, ultimately it will go away, but just because everything eventually dies down doesn't mean things are not, you know, worth paying attention to. And that cynicism has definitely been propagated by this current thing, right wing mentality. But the things that they debate are so, like, even the things that they debate are so boring. It's like this weird echo chamber where, like, people just can't figure out the fundamentals. It's a certain type of person that, like, think they would be like classics majors if they'd lived like 20 years ago, because they constantly have to be debating the fundamentals of art and education and aesthetics and architecture because they're so insecure with their own place in the world. And I almost think at that point, the more dignified thing to do would be to argue over Labubu, because nobody wants to talk about brutalism, you know, with a 20-year-old kid in San Francisco.
Labubuism.
I don't know if this is something that you've been a victim of on your timeline, David, but it's I guess it's pretty easy to ignore. But I kind of thought like
I'm trying. It makes me feel bad is the thing I've just realized. I mean, I have not to plug, not to be here to plug my book that's coming out in November, I wrote a 21st a history of the 21st century, a cultural history of the 21st
now that
century.
The 21st century is over. Yeah, we can put a pin in it.
Thank God.
Close the book.
It's felt really long.
But I guess like finishing the book radicalized me against the present moment in a way. Where before it was like I vaguely feel
you
bad
radicalized
about
yourself.
I radicalized myself. And then I just had a friend read it and he was like, "You've radicalized me. I hate our time so much." And so the tension here also is I'm supposed to be here as some sort of pundit, like, you know, explaining Labubu and what's going on. And at the same time, it's like, I don't want to have to think about these things at all. I don't want to have debates with right wing people who are in terrible bad faith, who either in bad faith or completely unaware that whatever position they have is just some sort of mechanistic anti-position to what they feel is like the liberal thing that oppresses them or whatever. Just like, I don't want to do any of this. I don't want to be online. I don't. But at the same time, I also know that being a Luddite is really boring in its own way. And then starting to be kind of this self-righteous guru who goes around being like, "Oh, you still have apps? Oof." Like, you know, I got rid of them and my, you know, everything's great now. My blood sugar levels are better or whatever, you know, so I don't want to be that person. So I'm trying to like figure out like, what do you do with this feeling? And so, you know, one of the, like the early things I'm experimenting with is just like, look at my phone less. And so, and especially like, don't get engaged with these. Yeah. We've seen these cycles so much that you know how it's going to go, you know, that they don't mean anything. And this is an incredibly weird parallel, but I used to watch Meet the Press a lot in the Iraq war times to be like, are people finally going to turn on Bush? Like, I'm going to every week watch and wait for that moment where it's like, I think we finally turned on Bush. And there's always some politician there who was going to defend the Iraq war position. Yeah. And whenever they opened their mouth and they had a Southern accent, I would just turn it off. Because it's like, whatever you say is in bad faith. I know that you're not going to say anything at all that has any meaning other than you're just a hack who's there to say hack talking points.
Yeah.
And so there's just so much at the moment where it's like, this is all just so rote. Like, everyone's just doing these things because they have to. And once you can see through it, it's not just that it's like makes me feel bad, but it's boring.
Yeah.
Like, all this is so boring because it's so predictable.
Yeah. David, I think if you could time your book promotion tour for this new book with your midlife crisis.
Yeah. Oh, it's happening.
This could really be exciting for you.
But I guess that crisis is, so I wrote my first book was about Japanese menswear, and I wrote it at a time in which Japanese menswear, I felt like that was the end of the fad, but it's only gotten bigger. Mm-hmm. But the main thing about that book, it's about people doing cool stuff that's still valued. And it's just like every page is like, here's another person doing a cool thing. And status and culture was more kind of objective and from behind, you know, here's the way things work. But I tried to talk about Whit Stillman and things that I like that excite me. And then this one, because it's about the 21st century, it was like I was forced to think about Kim Kardashian or Paris Hilton or these things that until now it's like it's just ambient knowledge. And I had to think about them. And I had to think about, you know, did Baby Gronk riz up Livy or whatever? Like, I have to, you know, think about these things, which I don't enjoy.
Did he?
You also have to hear, you have to watch the clips and hear these.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people have not been catching up with Baby Gronk. I need some more Baby Gronk news. What's the latest with Baby Gronk? But the point is, I don't like any of this. From a personal level, I don't like any of this. And I know that my readers are not going to be like, oh, Baby Gronk, cool. I should look into that. Like, I know that they're going to hate it too. And so it's like writing, it's torturous to write this thing that you know is negative. But at the same time, it's like you can't understand what's going on unless you actually think about these things holistically. And so it's not like, it is somewhat midlife crisis, which is, but it's also like 21st century, middle of 21st century crisis, which is, are we going to keep doing this? And you know, Charlie Wartzel just had this great piece in The Atlantic about AI too. And it was just like, are we going to do this? Like, all of this is insane. And no one's just stopping to say, are we going to do this next thing? They just do it. And I do feel like we're at an inflection point that I feel inside of me that I hope other people feel, where it's like, you know, we don't have to just keep on this treadmill if we all hate it.
I don't know how to get off. I do hate it, and I agree with you. I don't know how to get off. I did read too in one of your newsletters that you said you've been trying to spend less time online, and like that's my first thought is like, is it just one of those things where we all try to spend less time online? But it's on the other side too. It's one of those things where it's like, oh, if we all stop using plastic straws, we can stop global warming. When we all know that's not true, you know, the companies that are contributing the most to global warming have to stop doing the thing. And the companies that are, you know, building the platforms that thrive on your Baby Gronks and your Rizzlers, et cetera, have to stop producing
that's
the thing.
Child labor, right? Essentially.
But no, but I mean, it's like, it's the machines themselves are so profitable that nobody's going to turn them off. And it's like reduced to this individual choice when it's also so hard to just tune out.
Okay. I think that's a good point. Let me give you one counterpoint, which is if you think about straws, it's like, this is a collective action problem where all of us have to do this thing or it doesn't make any impact at all. But that's not the way culture works, which is that culture at the end of the day is still controlled by people with more social capital and cultural capital at the top. And so Facebook is a great example. So Facebook is used by no one other than really old people who can't tell the difference between AI and reality and like emerging internet populations across the world, right?
Yeah.
They still make a ton of money somehow. I don't understand how this works, but it's like the model is they've lost all of their savvy customers, but they can just pump money through this really broken system. But Zuckerberg, every time he opens his mouth, people believe him a little bit less because he just hasn't had a hit in a while. And he seems like he's following. There was a good article today also, I think, in New York Mag about him paying 9-figure salaries to people to get AI researchers as a sign of weakness. It's not a sign of strength. Right. Mm-hmm. So the point is that, yes, people aren't like Facebook makes a lot of money. We're not using it. How are we really making a difference? It was like in the long run, it will make a difference because his clout is disappearing as we move. And I think that's the point. It's that you can stop going to a club. Like a club can make a lot of money after it's uncool. It actually probably will make most of its money in its uncool period, not in its cool period, but we don't have to talk about it anymore and it can kind of fade out. And so, I mean, the number one problem with the 21st century, in my opinion, is not that bad things are happening because bad things have always happened, or bad taste is happening. There's always been bad taste, or that things with bad taste are popular. Like, that's always happened. It's that the narrative has been captured away from people with good taste or good or who care about innovation or whatever it is. And so there's things happening that are good that feel like they're in isolation that aren't the banner for our era. They're just like on the margins the same way that bad things are on the margins. And so the one thing is, like, we do have to retake control of the narrative, and we can do that by at least moving our mindshare away from using the bad stuff and also talking about the bad stuff in this sort of ironic way of, like, I know the bad stuff. Of course I know this. I wouldn't do it, but, like, you can come to me because I have this media literacy.
I'm pivoting to fintech.
Well,
it's my plan.
With your famous essay.
DeFi.
Did you, since finishing writing the book, have you, like, greatly decreased your screen time or whatever other metric of way of saying that you've been immersing yourself in all the muck? Have you,
it's impossible. I maybe like 15%. I think there's like once in a while where I'll have like a good couple hours, be like, I feel great. What's going on? It's like, oh yeah, I don't know where my phone is.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, I just lost my phone is somewhere and I don't know where it is. And that was like the best
thing. It's 3 hours in the couch cushions. This happens to me once a week.
And then I was I had this conversation with somebody, which to me, like, I keep bringing it up because it's like the cipher for our era. And we were discussing this kind of topic. And he said, I can't wait until I'm rich enough not to have a smartphone.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's it. Because what it means is that we all know we have to have this thing and it's a responsibility to have this thing, but it's not fun anymore. Mm-hmm. And when the smartphone started, it was obviously fun. Like, I just... Some Popeye article I had to translate where the guy was like, when I first got my iPhone, I just had fun going to the settings and changing the settings or whatever, because like the device itself is fun.
Yeah.
And so like we've lost that and we just feel like we have to have it. I have to have it on because there's going to be a ping from work on Slack that I have to, you know, look at or something. So it's just responsibility. There's no pleasure in it. And everyone I know, the pleasure that they take is like, in real life, I was in a place and I was hanging out with friends and it was amazing. We weren't on our phones. But then you have the anxiety and the FOMO of like, maybe somebody's pinging me. And if I don't get back to them in 30 seconds, they're going to get so angry because the expectation on response now is, you know, instant. And so it just, I think there's a flip. I think there's been a shift that is not, you don't need to... have the guru tell you to do this. It just like naturally happened where the internet was exciting. The smartphone was exciting. That was where value was. That was where status value was. And now it's, I think, flipped a different direction, which is like not being on your phone. You know, that's more valuable. You know that it seems actually cooler and you wish that you could succeed to a level in which you did not have to have a smartphone or be on social media.
I'm thinking of like part of my fear, right? Like, working in a world where I make my living by writing about what people do on the internet and the creator economy, right? Like, I really feel like I have to be so plugged in and know what's happening on Twitter, know what's happening on Instagram, which I don't really, because that's, I like zero in a little bit more on specific people. But in that context, I'm like connecting to it to something my dad told me recently. He moved to the US from Germany when he was like 40 years ago. And he said that when he goes back now, the German that he speaks is so old. Like, he doesn't have the new lingo. People like it's like it's literally like he's from the middle of the 20th century, right, when he's talking to people. And I'm realizing that's kind of what my fear is, that if
he's
I did
a linguistic time capsule,
he is that if I like, you know, deleted my Instagram, deleted my Twitter, not to mention the group chats I'm in on there, and that's like a part of my social life, whatever, that's another thing, but that I would lose some of the language, and that like if I was to talk to somebody in 6 months, like it would be like 7 years, right? And I wouldn't have the lingo. But even as I say that, I'm like, that literally doesn't matter, because I have some of my best friends are, you know, have deleted Twitter and like are not on these apps and like don't know the latest stupid reference, and it literally does not affect them. But I'm also thinking of somebody who like is a software engineer for a living and like does not have to traffic in any of these terms, does not have to talk about fucking Labubu on a podcast, right? Like,
right.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fear that, you know, not knowing who Baby Gronk is or the Rizzler or something is going to, why would I listen to you if you can't even tell me about the Drip King? You know, and the thing about this is, like, it's so funny, too, is it's unclear. I mean, okay, one problem is I live in Japan, and my vision of what America's like is very distorted through social media. So I do wake up every day and I read Twitter and I read X and I read Blue Sky and I look at Instagram or whatever. And I get a sense of, like, these are the stories happening. And
that's true. Every time I interact with David on American soil, he looks so confused, just like Paddington the bear wandering around.
but there are these, like, this ambient knowledge of America that doesn't get to me sometimes, and I get really shocked. And, like, the one that really hit me, like, 20 years ago was Larry the Cable Guy, because someone made a reference to Larry Cable Guy, and I was like, what are you talking about? And
they're like, you've been in Japan for 20 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, but the point is, I have this distorted view of the US through social media, but if I didn't have social media, I don't think I'd have a view at all. You know,
do you know about Times Square?
Yeah, but Times Square is a great example of I only knew the narrative. I only knew the backlash to the narrative. I didn't even know. I had obviously never been there until maybe like 2 years ago or something. Yeah. I like missed that whole period. I don't know who these people are. But at the same time, my reading of Times Square is that it was never real. Yeah. In a sense, but it's like, I can't judge that for myself.
Yeah.
I think whatever.
Speaking of Blue Sky, I was looking at your recent skeets over there, and I saw that you just read John Gans's When the Clock Broke, which I have not finished. I have it and I've started, but I've not finished. But I was wondering, in the same way that like purports to map, you know, a line from the 80s up until now and this Trumpian moment, Does your new book, which I'll read the full name. I don't know if we've said the full name. The new book out November 18th, I think, in the U.S. Blank Space: A Cultural History of the 21st Century. Does this do a similar thing in the context of kind of what we were talking about 15 minutes ago, of like telling us, like, here's why all this, you know, rising up, the Rizzler, Livy Dunn, Baby Gronk, like, here's why this all happened. And here's a possible solution in a similar way to how that maps up. Here are all these bubbles of early Trumpism, and here's kind of how we end it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I think he did an excellent book, and I think the book was particularly good if you knew these things as ambient knowledge, right? So, like, you know Ross Perot and you know David Duke, but you didn't quite connect that with Trumpism, and I think he did such a good job of especially finding quotes from that era where someone says something that's almost identical to something Trump has said now. So it takes a bunch of history that was, I mean, with all cultural history and with all narrative of art and culture, it always shifts because whatever the thing is at the moment, it has to be explained. It had roots somewhere. And so what you're always doing is like, going back and find, oh, there's the roots, and then uplifting them. So someone like David Duke was a marginal figure, but I think if Gans's narrative is now like the narrative, then okay, David Duke now is an important figure because it presages like what.
Who is the David Duke of Blank Space?
Yeah, so I mean, it's funny.
Or
it's
what? Like, I don't know if it's
very
event.
Clearly Gavin McInnes. And so like that one's easy. I mean, so the you know, one of the threads in the book is, it's not a political book, but you can't separate culture from politics at the moment. And I was in New York 2001 to 2003. I was there during 9/11. And I worked in downtown at this magazine called Tokion as an intern and then as a shop manager. But I was there when Vice was really at its peak. And like Vice was not just at its peak. I think maybe it peaked later as a media entity, but it was at its peak of being like the central force of New York culture. So like, Ryan McGinley and Gavin were going around and you just got a sense that they were kind of, they at least made themselves to be the heart of it. And so when you go back and look at that culture, and when I was in it, I was like, Terry Richardson to me seems like a rapist, but hey, who am I? You know, if everyone around me thinks this guy is like God's gift to feminism, then who am I to really have this crazy thought in my head? again, you know, that's Lilith Fair me being like, Terry Richardson doesn't seem good. And then Gavin, everything he was writing and doing was like, this seems crypto right wing to me. Like there's something really inherently not performative racist, but actually racist, mm-hmm. Obviously anti-PC, but like going beyond that. And so, and everyone was just like, oh, it's all funny, ironic. It's like when he's using the N-word, it's like it's a crazy funny, isn't that a cool transgressive joke that he's doing? It's like Jackass. So for him to later found the Proud Boys, it was like, thank you. Like I knew this was coming. So I think the book does a couple of things in the kind of, let's say, the Gans model, which is, where does culture kind of fall apart? And I liked Filter World, and I think like to blame the algorithm is true. The algorithm hasn't helped, but that's like, I don't know, 2017. And when you go back and look at the history, everything kind of broke immediately in the 21st century. It didn't take us to 2017 for things to break. And capitalism is not good either, but it's not just capitalism. And I think when you go back to the early 21st century, when you look at like the years 2000 to 2005, and you look at the critics that are called Poptimism, and you look at what was going on at Vice, which is like performative anti-liberalism, and you look at what Poptimism was kind of like, being an indie snob, or being interested in avant-garde aesthetics is oppressive, and obviously Christina Aguilera is the greatest punk who's ever lived, like this kind of crazy counterintuitive hyperbole, you already had the seeds of, oh, this whole 21st century is going to be all about pop, and it's going to be about performative anti-liberalism. And so, I mean, I think that is what the book is about in a sense, was that the 90s, and it was a very brief moment, but that indie liberal culture, progressive, Kurt Cobain, LGBTQ plus ally kind of world became actually seen as so mainstream, or seen as so, either you saw it as like Nirvana's, like a kid down the street likes Nirvana, so there's nothing cool about that, or it became Limp Bizkit and you're like, I don't like the direction that it went, that you had to be against some of these things that were, I think, liberal dogma, which is like being progressive and being being progressive in a really classical liberal sense, and then also thinking that artistic innovation is good. And so then you get kind of the like, Kid A is the worst Radiohead album because it's the most experimental, like that kind of thing. And you get the kind of flowing into now. So I think the archaeology that I've done is more just looking at that era and saying before technology and capitalism had a chance to ruin culture, like we did it ourselves.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about Trump is like people think he has no culture, but that's actually not true. His culture is like the culture of the 80s. Like he actually is somebody who cares deeply about a certain type of culture. It's just mm-hmm. like a narcissistic refracting of what was popular when he was sort of like most pleased with himself. And every normal person also, I think, has their own internal nostalgia cycle where the kind of culture that they ultimately settle on is like whatever was popular when they were in whatever they consider their prime. But most people have the like mental elasticity to start to incorporate contemporary things that they also like on top of the baseline stuff they identify with. And I think he just straight up doesn't have that ability. Old. He is old. He is
very old, very addled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it is like the stuff that he goes to bat for, like the Broadway stuff. It's just like fascinating because it's like there's something else going on there other than a vacuum of culture. I think he's surrounded by people who have a profound lack of culture, but I think it's not that he's uncultured. It's that he's just a profoundly self-centered individual.
I mean, this is another good example of where the word culture really trips us up, because you're using it in some ways to mean high culture, that when we say Trump doesn't have a sense of culture, he doesn't care about high culture, which obviously he doesn't, but he has a deep interest in certain things. He has tastes for certain things. Mm-hmm. I think the well-done steak is not that he doesn't care about steak. It's that he loves well-done steaks. Like, that's his taste. And
well, also the same thing. Yeah. Well, New York in the 80s, like, the relationship to high culture was not as entrenched, like, as it would be now. Like, that was sort of, like, not to, like, paraphrase Nora Ephron, but, like, that was sort of the beginning of restaurants as culture. And, like, mm-hmm. yeah, maybe, like, going to a restaurant is kind of like going to a Broadway show. I think you can see, like, aspects of that in his mentality.
Yeah, and people keep talking about culture is dead in the 21st century. And the important thing that I'm trying to say also is culture has been a huge part of the 21st century, mm-hmm. right? People have made so much money on culture. There's more billionaire cultural creators than ever before. There's billions of people who create culture on a daily basis for the first time. The monopoly on only nerds can make culture is over. That culture has driven politics insanely. That for both on the left and the right, like, there's all these outcomes that have happened because of culture, and that culture is, sorry, I said, oh, it, in terms of like pure entertainment, have we all been entertained over the last 25 years on a daily basis? Like, there's been a lot of stuff that's happened.
I've been pretty entertained. Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
I also think, like, as you're speaking and saying, like, we left behind this idea that only nerds can make culture. When you're saying, like, Zuckerberg, every time he opens his mouth, he's less convincing. We're also, like, weirdly at the point where we're leaving behind the idea that only nerds can make technology. Mm-hmm. But I think in the short term, that's going to make the culture war a lot worse, because everyone understands, like, nerds versus jocks, or like revenge of the literary nerds or revenge of the tech nerds. But when it's like open season on skill sets that have previously belonged to subcultures with their own norms, that's, I think, when things get really stochastic, because, you know, I don't want to see, like, magazine people. Maybe people don't want to see magazine people making software.
Well, where this gets to for me is, like, the new learn to code is learn to do marketing, right? I think that, like, what the creator economy has done and what the lowering of barriers to any kind of cultural production or to making software, like you're saying, Daisy, what that's done is, like, it's forced everyone to be a marketer, to learn mm-hmm. how to distribute an idea. And, you know, what's prized is not the idea itself, not the product, but the distribution of it, which then is inextricable from the product. So I wonder, though, that then that, like, backlashes to a sort of, like, I read this NASCAR book this summer. Oh, wow. The latest. Hard to go an episode of the pod without bringing up NASCAR. But no, it's one of his latest fiction ones. But there's this band in it that they don't have any tapes. The only way you can see them is, like, by being invited to go see them on, like, once a year on some, like, random farm deep in the middle of nowhere, Sweden. And I thought that was so cool, right? And I think, like, that's then the next, like, double sellout or whatever, is when everybody's a marketer. What's cool is when you do that. But of course, you can only do that if you can afford to pay your rent through being a marketer.
Yeah, but here's my question about, like, this. This is one of the justifications for, like, everyone has to be a sellout now because things are so expensive, et cetera, et cetera. And I do get that, like, New York used to be cheap and New York is expensive. So let's just cut New York out of it, because New York is not the only place you can make things. But, like, do people think healthcare was super affordable in 1993? Like no one's ever explained to me that, like, oh, you don't get it. Like, in 93, when we had universal healthcare and, you know, I don't know what has changed. I just think that one of the fundamental issues with society is that everyone's, like, mental level of what a middle class lifestyle is like a millionaire's lifestyle,
as fragmented.
Like a multi-millionaire's lifestyle. So, like, if you're on Instagram, no one flies economy in the entire, like, corpus of Instagram. There's never been a single photo of anyone in an economy seat.
I fly.
Well, but you don't post it.
Yeah, we all fly economy is the point. Everyone flies economy, except that no one talks about it. And so in the like mindshare, what flying on a plane is like, look at my feet up. Oh, I just happened to be hey, go into LA and then here's my feet. Like, oh, I wonder why your feet are up. I wonder what that's signaling. So, you know, if everything is, hey, I'm in Italy this weekend, then of course you can't afford the lifestyle. But then the other part of this, and like before I get like preachy, is I don't know what the right size lifestyle is anymore. I don't know how to tell somebody do this instead, because this is what you should be paying for. But the idea that I've got to sell out because I just need to pay my bills, that part I understand. But then you get all of the George Clooney type people who are, it's like, oh, you couldn't pay your bills, or like The Rock or whoever. It's like they have to start their own product lines because like they can't pay healthcare. Like what is the reason why the people who have succeeded still feel like they have to do it? Or like Emma Chamberlain, do you have to make a commodity coffee company? Mm-hmm. I keep picking on her, but like she's just an example. Someone's like, you gotta have your whole life in front of you. Things are going really well. Louis Vuitton has brought you in as like one of, you're like in the team, and you make videos and you have revenue and all these things are great. But like, do you have to do it? And my other problem with Addison Rae is, and like, people really get angry when you like pick on Addison Rae, but it's kind of like, it just felt like music was her stepping stone to another big like marketing bonanza or something. It does not feel to me that it's like an earnest, like I really want to make music and therefore I'm doing this thing. It just felt like in order to be the Addison Rae marketing machine, the one thing that was missing was kind of like a big hit or something. So that I'm going to go into the direction of music. So get Max Martin's people, and we'll get into a room and we'll make some stuff and we'll say kick drum, chew gum or whatever. And every critic in America will be like, there's no line has been written more deeply than kick drum, chew gum. This is the smartest thing. It's so smart how dumb it is. It's so deep how superficial it is. Mm-hmm. It's so earnest how cynical it is. Like, and every major publication will just
optimism
like,
never
put
dies.
you on a platform for being a complete sellout.
I have a theory. I do think contemporary celebrity is an extreme form of ego death, and that human beings are not wired to experience themselves as a product at scale. And I think with some of these celebrities, like selling something other than themselves becomes like a way to take back control from the fact that you cannot un-celebrity. Like being a celebrity used to be a double-sided door. Now it's a one-way portal. Like if you become famous, you cannot become unfamous. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably, I mean, I wish there was like more writing about celebrity psychology. I think if you like did a study, you would find that like, that there's actually something profoundly traumatic about not being able to be unfamous, just like any other thing that could happen to somebody that's irreversible. And so I just wonder if they're like become marketers as a way to be like, okay, I will never truly own my identity again, but I can sell other things that don't require me, my presence, my identity.
That's very smart. I mean, I'd also say, if you think of like Ashton Kutcher, what is he going to do? I mean, he can be
he's a noted and respected venture capitalist.
That's what I'm saying. So it's like, okay, so he's in the 70s show and he's in some films and he's in like, that's kind of waning. I think he's actually a very good actor. So this is not even a critique on that, but it's much, he is status wise a lot higher now being like the genius investor of all these companies. I just saw him. He's going to be on the board of Soho House because it, you know, got privatized or whatever.
Right.
But it's like these people have completely found a second life that maybe is even more prestigious than just being an actor or having been have been. Like I have been an actor by being an entrepreneurial hero, and that's like another thread of the book, is like this idea that entrepreneurs are heroes. I think is a very 21st century idea. And
yes,
it is, especially to the degree of, it doesn't really matter how you got the money. Like if you made neurotropic pills that you claim have all these effects and people are stupid enough to buy them, that's good on you. You're an incredible marketer if you were able to make that happen. There's no stigma. Whereas I think for a long time, it's like, yes, you're a gambler and you made a lot of money, but we're not going to treat you like an actual wealthy person.
Well, there's, for example, yesterday as we record, Alex Hormozi, I don't know all the stuff about this, but from what I understand, he released a book and he he broke some record for most books sold in 24 hours. But I think it was only because he offered the option to buy like a pack that was like $5,000 and included like 200 books you can redeem to give other people. So you're not really buying the books, but people bought this, which is insane because what are you doing? You're just like, you're literally just like using your money to worship at the altar of Hormozi, which is just worshiping at the altar of this 21st century entrepreneurship. So I'm sure, you know, some people are going to buy these books and read them and learn a lot from them. But like, that's just so insane. It just has no appeal to me. Like,
yeah.
I'd much rather go to my local bookstore and buy two books. Now, maybe I'm getting preaching and complaining, but like, I don't know. Like, that's just like the pure, that's such a pure distilled entrepreneurial worship that I do not understand. Like, the scale is what people desire above all else, and there's always more scale to get at, right? I think one of the funniest terms to me in entrepreneurialism is total addressable market, right? Because any entrepreneur, any startup founder, whatever, it's always, this is our TAM, right? This is our total addressable market. You're never going to reach it, you know, but it's always there, and you're always going to be reaching for more of it, but you're never going to reach it. And it's kind of this like thing you can always struggle at. But I guess I'm saying that as sort of an answer to what we're posing of like, why does Ashton Kutcher then want to go do that? Because his total addressable market of consumers, just generally, mm-hmm. consumers for what? It doesn't matter.
But well,
your total addressable market.
Yeah. Increases. Attention is easier to extract than money, but people run out of attention before they run out of money. Mm-hmm. I think that bottleneck is going to be the next thing that people try to like blow open with AI, perhaps even myself. You know, part of, we talk about like the envy between the right and the left and who was anointed culture-wise and not, how much that's changing. You know, for a while it's like culture, like media had cultural capital, tech had the money. Now it was like media had the attention, tech had the money. Now tech also wants the attention. Mm-hmm. But everything, the amount of stuff that's being put into the world by AI is actually kind of like undercutting and creating almost like inflationary engagement. And so like this moment of entrepreneurs being cool, like you talk about The Social Network as the most important, one of the most important movies of the 21st century so far. And I completely agree because it represents the moment at which Facebook was able to capture both kind of like cultural capital, attention and money.
Yep.
But clearly like that's over. And so what we're seeing right now in America is like not just the sort of Trump style smash and grab on like real capital resources, but it's also a smash and grab on people's like attention, values, and like their relationship to the stuff that they like. And that to me is like almost even more upsetting.
Yeah. I mean, look, this, the 21st century, it's really easy to do the knee jerk, like, you know, late stage capitalism. Late stage capitalism, everybody, and like, you don't have to explain anymore. But what late stage capitalism.
Time.
Late stage capitalism.
That's about late stage capitalism.
Uh huh. And it came out, that's pre 2000, right?
Well, like you 90s. Have to amend the book. Stop the presses.
Late stage capitalism, it's not just that it's like some sort of nefarious conspiracy against us. The point is like it changes human incentives. Mm-hmm. And it, one of the things that has been happening for a long time is that some sort of morals and norms we've all decided should like be thrown out the window. And so obviously capitalism would like us to not have any morals and norms because it's just a lot easier to sell things. And one of the things that on the left for a long time in like avant-garde culture was like morals and norms are just the tools of middle class, parochial oppression. So we need to get rid of them. And now everyone's trying to get rid of them, but we live in a world in which there is absolutely no value system mm-hmm. that can counteract capitalism. And then we're like, what happened? Like, why is everything just a scam? It's like, because scams are like the purest form of if you had a capitalism that didn't have any kind of punishment for breaking rules. And so like one of the things about this book is just like, yes, if you erode all norms, because some of these norms were important for like aligning society to take action, to do things that were good for society. Like that's the point of a norm, is to say like, is the prisoner dilemma, or if you think about a mafia omerta, like the point of the omerta is to say like, our norm is if that nobody talks, we get this good outcome, which is that no one goes to prison. And so we're going to enforce this by calling you a rat or murdering you if you talk. And so there's a norm in place. And so the norms that we had in society like had points. Like they weren't just there to because like we were oppressing people. So if we had a norm against, if you make money off a scam, you're not allowed to be in polite society, versus if you make money from something that's social productive, you can be in polite society. That was a pretty clear norm where, number one, it encouraged younger people not to go into scams. Mm-hmm. And number two, it meant that society was like mobilizing its resources towards non-scams. And now if you get rid of that and everybody's a scammer and everyone wants to be a scammer, you're like, what happened? Like, why is this happening? It's like, because there's no... We've elevated the scammers to the top of society, and there's no norm that's trying to get rid of them. So of course this is what happens.
Well, like the free market also works better if people don't cheat. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw the article.
In theory,
there's the article in The Economist that basically like the US is becoming more like China in the sense that like they had state sponsored communism, yeah. And now we have state sponsored capitalism. It's like the opposite of like the European system. Like in the European system, the state sponsors your welfare and basic needs and leaves the actual commerce to the free market. Now the US is like, yeah, sponsoring commerce and leaving people's basic needs to the free market. And that's crazy. That's also like not really what capitalism is supposed to be either. And so like a lot of these, like you're saying, late stage capitalism, the critique kind of needs to be updated, because like what we're dealing with now is not the free market run amok. It's state interference.
It's feudalistic capitalism. But I guess, yeah, this is the thing too, that is really given a lot of people despair about this Trump moment, which is that the first Trump moment, it's like, this is bad that he has power, but there's a sense that the system
that of
people
norms
with money, institutions are going to fight back against it because they understand that this is bad for them in the long run, right? And now it's kind of like you do not see that. And so it's there's some sort of short-term thing they're trying to get out of him, but also they don't care about the long-term downstream. So like the thing you're saying is, okay, if capitalism really is going to be like successful, it needs to not be tied up in the state. It needs to not have like the government picking winners and losers and all the things that free market people said in the past. But nobody in these institutions is thinking about that, because at the end of the day, a CEO is only the CEO because of shareholder capitalism, and because if they do not raise shareholder value, they will lose their jobs. So their number one goal at that very moment is to raise shareholder value, which at the moment means getting on Trump's good side, because Trump can get an institution to go against you or can say something negative about you and make the share price drop. So we're in a system in which the whole thing is captured by capitalism, but the short-term idea is to go along with it, even if you can see the bad consequences in the future. But I don't know how to get out of that. I mean, it's really just kind of despair driving, because all the incentives, again, are aligned to make the people in power now have power until they don't.
Well, a lot of people in power are old. I think they don't expect to be around for the majority of the consequences. And they know that their children will, but they think if they can make enough money and leave it to the children, they can insulate themselves from the consequences.
Do you really not think there's going to be an AI version of Trump that people consult? You know, so Trump dies, they make an AI version of him using, they have so much material. So many voice
Tupac
recordings.
Tupac hologram V10.
They've got the hologram AI Trump, and people are still like, you know, the way that people evoked Ronald Reagan, you know, Republicans evoked Ronald Reagan in the 2000s or whatever. They're going to be like, here's the Trump hologram. He just endorsed me for mayor of Nebraska, of Des Moines or whatever. And so, you know, these people are never going away. And like, this is the other interesting about the 21st century, is as much as we're like, everything shallow and now, and it's about this moment, our heroes are still Bob Dylan. Our heroes are still Miles Davis, or, you know, Kurt Cobain or whatever it is, because no one's been as cool like in this 21st century period. So we're still going back to them. And the thing about Trump is I think there's, I do not think there's going to be a period in which he is not seen as some sort of John the Baptist figure for find Jesus, whatever, one of those, for, you know, for this whole group of people.
You're probably right. And bleak. I think we're gonna end the episode on this bleak note. Don't
know. Give me,
wait, guys,
give me something positive.
How
something
I can positive. Tell you something positive. AI okay. JFK.
AI JFK. What about AI?
Just Mayor Quimby.
AI LBJ. It's just really fun to say the acronym with AI.
But the problem is people on the left will be like, well, we don't like AI holograms. We're about the moment. I don't even have a phone. You know, that's going to obviously going to be a major bifurcation in terms of
at the end of the day, though, there's still a boo-boo in Karl Marx's grave.
Oh, my, that, mm-hmm,
that should be your cover photo. Oh, you already have a cover. But if you know,
the UK edition.
I was going to say UK edition. OK,
is it a Taylor Swift thing? Blank space. Is that Taylor Swift? Yeah. No, of course. Yeah.
And like, and it's, it, I mean, the book isn't like anti Taylor Swift, but it's like she's clearly the symbol of the 21st century in the sense of very successful and a sense of
what an incredible
business.
Well.
Yeah. Incredible business person.
Yeah.
And that's what's important. And there, you know, whether I would love someone to write like complete rebuttal of my book in some ways from the perspective of like, no, it's good that the culture is just business now.
Well, but, wait, really, really quick. I haven't read it yet, but Kat D wrote a good rebuttal to your Labubu piece, right?
Yeah, but it's not Pirate Wires. So not your book. I'm going to read it. Sorry, Kat. I don't read Pirate Wires.
We're kind of, I'm forced myself to be in dialogue with her in the sense of like, I forced myself into it. But she had written a good piece a while back about the culture is not dead. It's just you're not noticing where it is. And,
yes.
And that is an argument that I disagree with, but I'm really sympathetic to, which is I want that to be true. Mm-hmm. And so one of her examples was kind of like vaudevillian TikTok videos are a new format that didn't exist in the 90s. And that's like where cultural innovation is. It just, when I watch vaudevillian TikTok videos and to give an example, it's where the people talk to each other because they're playing different characters.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's like, they're okay, but they are not the vehicle for intense avant-garde experimentation, the way that the 20th century got moved. So like, I think that's the right attitude to go look for where, you know, maybe it's not the novel, maybe it's not the film, maybe it's these new formats. Like I love that idea. I just don't know if those were the right things yet that are going to save us. But I think that's the thing too. It's like, you know, and I wasn't even trying to be that anti-Labubu. It's just saying for me personally, it's like, I'm not interested in this. And like, I'm not interested in fads. And her perspective was, well, you could also from the same time be like, this stuff is great. I love it. Like, I love learning about it. And I'm sure there are tons of people like that, and that's fine. It's just, for me, it all comes down to not, and I don't want to be the scold of your taste is good or your taste is bad. It's more the ecosystem has a bunch of things moving in it, and it has effects. And in the 20th century, we loved the effects of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
And now we don't like the effects of the ecosystem. We're like, why is that true? And it's because it's lacking other people doing things. And so it's not necessarily, let's say in the 90s, New Kids on the Block were very popular, the same way the Backstreet Boys were popular, the same way that BTS is popular now. It's just that New Kids on the Block was a marginal thing compared to other pop music and grunge and college rock or whatever was going on. And so it's like today, it's like if it's only New Kids on the Block, and then you're like, why is culture not innovative? Then like, well, you've just answered your own question, right? And so to me, it's not necessarily that we have to get rid of all this stuff or not enjoy it. It's more that there has to be something else, and there's no institution, there's no natural mechanism that is moving us towards valuing cultural innovation and putting it into the narrative. And that's the thing that we have to work on. And that's what it is.
And that's where I'll end it. That's a more upbeat note. Blank Space, A Cultural History of the 21st Century, out November 18th.